all of the volunteers who have made this possible today. Thank you very much. I would now like to introduce to you our speaker for today. His name is Quinn P. And Quinn, there it is. Quinn came into AA on August 4th, 2019. He has 3 years of sobriety. And his home group is the Monday Night Milkshake Meeting in Herndon. We are very excited to have Quinn here with us today. So please, everybody, welcome Quinn.
Everybody in front of the alcohol. Thank you guys so much. It's so great to be here. Before I get into the last one, can we give another round of applause for everyone that's put on the track with us this time?
Smarter than me, that person's funnier than me, okay, that person's definitely taller than me. I'm like 5'1" right now. You got on the stage, I didn't go see you were taller than me at the moment. But it was always just sort of comparing myself to others. I always kind of felt like I was walking to school, and I felt like, I'm not sure if you guys have ever had this moment before, I'm almost 100% sure you have. I would walk into a room, and I feel like everyone in that room met before. Like, every single person in that room had hung out and met before. And I was getting to this point of, like, I feel like I missed orientation. I just missed orientation. How are people able to adjust to life so easily, and I feel like I'm struggling? But what ended up happening is I ended up starting looking at my life on a ladder. You were above me, you were below me on the ladder. I would compare people that I thought maybe were worse than me, but I was looking at my life on a ladder. And I can you probably imagine how exhausting it is to live life like that. It is so tiring to constantly live life comparing yourself to others. And it talks in the big book about how Bill talks about I had arrived. If anyone on earth needed to feel like he had arrived, it was 15-year-old Quinn. I had pimples on my face. I'm hanging out. I'm wearing the same pair of sweatpants that I've been wearing since freshman year of high school. And I'm wearing that. I'm doing that whole thing. I remember the first time that I ever drank alcohol, all that comparing myself, all those anxieties, all the insecurities melted away. I didn't feel it anymore. The best way I've ever heard it described to me is that the 9-step promises came true the first time I drank alcohol. Situations that used to baffle me weren't baffling me anymore. Fear of economic insecurity? I'm buying shots. Let's drink, baby. That's me when I was drinking. And the best way I can describe it is alcohol put me in the middle of the room. Where before, I didn't feel like I was invited to the room. I didn't even know where the room was. And now I'm in the middle of the room. That's pretty sweet. And how I always like to say it is the physical addiction to alcohol came later. The tremors, the hospital visits. But from that moment on, I was mentally addicted to alcohol. Because everything that used to be good enough to me wasn't good enough for me anymore. Okay, Quinn, you want to come over and watch the game tonight? Yeah, can we get beer? Hey, Quinn, you want to come over and play ping pong? Yeah, can we take shots before? Like, it was all these things I used to love doing and find true joy in doing. I didn't find true joy in anymore. There had to be alcohol. I very quickly became that friend that would get way too drunk and do stupid things and Quinn, you were crazy last night. I implemented a no stories rule very quickly into my drinking, and people being like, "Oh man, Quinn, like, stop!" I want to remember that. That was sort of how I drank, and I went into college. I went to the University of Maryland, which is my family's school. My parents met there. Grandfather went there. I grew up a giant Maryland fan. My entire life, I just wanted to go to the University of Maryland, and I got there. I put my feet on campus, and I hated it. I legitimately hated it. I was like, I cannot, like, it's not what I thought it was going to be. I was a small fish in a big pond. It was this idea of, like, it felt like the same way when I missed orientation. Kids were coming out, hanging out on the floor, and I wanted to break out of my shell. I wanted to break out, but I couldn't. I was too insecure to kind of break out of my shell. And I don't think my insecurities and my story is that unique to anybody else. I don't think it's unique to alcoholics. The reason I'm bringing it up is I feel like most kids I went to school with faced that insecurity and grew from it, and I just drank from it. I lost an opportunity to grow in that situation. Because I went there and I was so insecure, I didn't want to be there, and I knew I had a trump card in my back pocket, alcohol. I know if I have alcohol, my things will melt away. I can be the Quinn I want to be, I can laugh, I can joke around, I can be in the middle of the room again. I remember the first night I had the opportunity to drink in college. The first time, my friend's brother was 21 years old. He brought us all alcohol. It was the first time in my life I ever had my own bottle of liquor. I felt like a king for a day. I was a man. I got my own bottle of liquor. I'm hanging out in the glass. And that night, I went to the hospital with blood alcohol poisoning. That's how I drink alcohol. When I drink alcohol, I have no clue what's going to happen next. I have little control over how much I take. And I would love to be able to tell you some more funny stories, but the truth is, and Marty pointed out to me one time, I can't remember it. Anyway, cannot remember a whole lot of my drinking. I probably blacked out 95% of the time that I put alcohol in my body. And if you've never had that experience, not everyone here is a blackout drinker, that's perfectly fine. I'm not an alcoholic because alcohol put me in the courtrooms, hospital beds. I'm not an alcoholic because I went to court 3 times in the span of 6 months, and I showed up, and the bailiff was like, "Hey, Quinn, what's going on?" And I was like, my legal name is Norman. How do you know my nickname? I'm not an alcoholic because I was referred to my school substance abuse center 4 separate times. By the end of my junior year, I felt like I was Norm from Cheers. I just walked in and went, "Oh, Quinn!" I'm like, "Oh my goodness." I need to stop coming around here so often. But the reason I'm an alcoholic, and I can talk about the consequences, but the consequences didn't bring in anything to me. For me, drinking and going, waking up in bushes, courtrooms, hospital beds, was the price of doing business. That's just part of it. If I want to drink the way I like to drink alcohol, I have to be okay with having a lawyer, like, a lawyer on retainer. My mom called the lawyer one time and said, "Tell me about my son's case." The lawyer said, "Which case?" Like, that's how I drink alcohol. I had to be okay with that. The issue was that I dealt with was emotionally. It felt like I was drowning while everyone else around me was breathing. I was in college, and I thought people were finding fulfillment in jobs and relationships and school, and I was still stuck in quicksand, and I was sinking. I didn't know how to get out. I would talk to every single person, and I'd be like, "How do you guys just get up and go to class? How do you get up, and how do you guys apologize when you're wrong? I just keep doubling down. Like, what do you guys do?" And it just kind of felt like I was sinking, and it was like this idea, like, I would black out. Every time I would black out, I would wake up and I'd punch the pillow. And I'd be thinking, what is wrong with me? I just thought I was stupid. Like, I just thought I was dumb. I didn't know about this disease. I didn't know anything about the phenomenon of craving. I just thought I was really stupid. And I would wake up and I would punch the pillow, and that fear, bewilderment, anxiety would all hit me. And someone would text me, like, "Hey, Quinn, you want to drink tonight?" Because all my defenses leave in possession of the first drink. I don't really have a chance at that. I graduated college. I went to law school. Not sure what's going on with that law school that they let me in. I challenge the admissions practices of that law school. They let me into the school. But in that law school, I ended up hitting 3 separate rock bottoms. And that's where I sort of learned, like, as an alcoholic, the only rock bottom I can truly hit is death. The only rock bottom that I will ever hit is death, because whatever I think is my rock bottom, there's always a trap door. It will always get worse than I think it's going to get. I don't even believe that alcoholics really just hit different points of surrender. They just hit different points of, like, maybe I'll try to do something a little bit more. Maybe I have enough pain that I can do a little bit more. And through 2019, I really thought, it can't get worse than this. And I kept drinking, and it kept getting worse. And I remember the second one, I remember I went over to my friend's place. I ended up blacking out 3 times in 2 days. I walked home. I walked home, went into my bed, and I remember my first thought was, as I lay there, for the first time ever thinking this, I can't control how much I drink. I have no control over how much I drink. I didn't want to black out. I didn't want that to happen. And I did. And as I sat there, I thought, maybe you should stop drinking. Maybe you should quit drinking. Then the next thought was, I can't stop drinking. I can't imagine a world without alcohol. At that moment, I was at the jumping off point. I'm able to live a life sober, I live a life with alcohol. I knew I couldn't live with either, so I thought about killing myself. I thought maybe the best case scenario for me is to kill myself. And honestly, you know what stopped me? I don't know how to tie a knot. I never did Boy Scouts. Thanks, Dad, for not putting me in Boy Scouts. It saved my life. because straight up, like, I was just laying there, and I was like, I'm too tired of drinking. Even Google had to tie a knot right now. I'm just going to drink until I die. I was 22 years old at the time. I'm going to probably be dead by the time I'm 25, and I'm okay with that. I'm 100% okay with that. And then the next few months, there's really no point in even talking about it, because I was just blacking out like crazy, being the worst version of myself, snapping at people. 2 of my best friends pulled me aside and, like, "Please tell us what's wrong. Are you okay? Like, what's wrong?" And I told them, like, "Guys, I'm going to die. I've accepted it. Like, you need to accept it too. I'm going to die." And they started to cry, and I couldn't understand why they were crying. I was like, "Guys, I've accepted this faith. Like, this is like, I've signed this social contract. I'm going to die with alcohol, and that's okay with me." And I really drank like that. That was, so that second rock bottom was in March. As I said, my sobriety is August 4th. I kept drinking like that, and then one day, I went to a Steve Miller Band concert. Yo, man, he was laughing. He was playing the Joker, and the whole time I was thinking, like, can you wrap it up, Steve Miller? I got drinking to go do, man. Stop playing the Joker for the second time. It's ridiculous. And so then after that, I remember I went over to my friend's place, started a three-day bender. I woke up, and I remember thinking to myself, I only want to drink enough so my mom doesn't know I took any. Bottle ends up finished. I wake up, and I hear, like, I can't breathe. I feel like someone's sitting on my chest. And I'm thinking, like, I need to go to the hospital. So I get to the hospital, and it's kind of spilled out of me. Like, I drank a lot. I black out every time I drink, and I don't know what to do. And the doctor said, this is alcohol withdrawal. They're going through alcohol withdrawal right now. And I heard, not a top five thing you like to hear when you're in the hospital, we're taking you to the ICU. And I remember I was freaking out, like, what do you mean they're in the ICU? I'm fine, I don't want to go that long. And they were just like, no, we're only taking you to the ICU because we don't have any more beds available. That's how we're taking you to the ICU. I'm like, cool, I can live with that. I'm in the ICU. I think I'm going to be there for a day. I was there for like three, four. I was there for 4 days. And it was a whirlwind. All I remember, I was just being the worst version of myself. I was yelling at the nurses that were trying to keep me alive. I was yelling at my mom, who was just scared. My mom's only child, probably his only son. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm just like, I just remember just being, I was so angry at myself. But I was too much of a coward to turn it inward and turn it out everybody else. I made everyone else hostage in my own misery. And I remember my mom had to leave. She had, like, visiting hours over. And she came to kiss me on the forehead goodbye, and I grabbed her hand. And I said, please don't make me stop drinking. Please. I'll do chores. That's all I can offer up. Like, I'll wash the dishes every Tuesday. Yeah, I don't like that. And so, I get out of the hospital. I think I'm not sure if my dad remembers this. I remember I told my parents, I'm going to have 6 to 8 drinks a day and chill. And my parents were like, what the heck is going on here? What's happening? But something that I learned at that time that I didn't know until I got sober was God was always listening. God was always talking to me. I just needed to listen. I needed to have that God give me the humility to listen. And what happened is my uncle from Texas, who's an ER doctor in Austin, just happened to be in town. I see this dude once every 2 years, once a year if I'm lucky. He just happened to be in town that weekend. I was thinking like that every weekend. It was a miracle I went to the hospital that weekend that he happened to be there. I remember I showed up, my dad drove me there. Last time I mentioned this story on a podcast, my dad called me, are you going to mention how I told you to go? I drove over, my dad drove me to the place. I see my uncle. He gives me a can of Coca-Cola and comes on a basketball game and said, Quinn, remember all that took to make you happy? Remember when this is good enough for you? This can be good enough for you again. And then he said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that life got too difficult that you felt like you couldn't do it without alcohol. But I promise you it won't always be too difficult. And I don't know, for some reason I believed him. I remember so vividly, I was playing at the basketball game, poking this on a white wall. And I'm looking to the left of the television, trying to stare a hole through this white wall. And at 1 second, I'll do anything to drink again. And the next second, I'll do anything to get sober. I'm happy to say that's the same desire to stay sober that I have today. And it's just an amazing thing because I thought to myself, okay, I'll do anything to get sober. And after you have that thought, it's like, anyone know how? Can anyone help me out? I have no idea. And my life changed forever when I got the God-given gift of humility to take suggestions. That's when my life changed. That's when things started working out and I started feeling like a true member of society again. When I had the God-given gift of humility to put my weapons down, put things down, like, I don't know best. So I'm not sure about you guys. I had higher powers when I was drinking. Alcohol and my logic. And that got me into courtrooms and hospital beds. But the substitute center at the University of Maryland treated me like I'm Norman from Cheers. That's what that took me to. And so I remember thinking to myself, there has to be something else. There has to be a better way. And my uncle told me, you should go to rehab. And rehab told me I need to go to AA. And AA told me I need to sit in the front row. And I said, I'll go to AA, but I'm not sitting in the front row. Those are the tryhards, man. I think it's in the back. Pull out my hood. I don't want to talk to anybody. It's going to be sweet. So I remember I showed up to my first AA meeting, which is now my home group at St. Tim's, 8:30 p.m. And I remember I showed up and I sat in the back row, as my plan was. And I remember there was a voice that I know it's not mine. My voice doesn't like to make me uncomfortable. The voice in my brain wants to tell me to curl up in a ball, watch the same episode of television I've watched 25 times, so I know exactly what's going to happen, and stay comfortable. That's what my voice tells me to do. But for some reason, a voice that is definitely a power greater than myself said, if you're going to be here, be here. If you're going to be in this room, be in this room. And so I sat up, and I walked to the front row, and I plopped down, and I didn't say anything for 3 weeks. I didn't say one word. But I saw three things in my first AA meeting that I ever went to, and the three things I see in this room today. I saw the camaraderie of friendship. We're joking around. We made How It Looks a freaking party today. I was at a music festival with How It Looks. I saw camaraderie of friendship, people laughing and joking the way I never thought I could without alcohol. I saw tangible evidence that it works. People weren't the same. It wasn't really the amount of years that people talked about that impressed me. People were saying things like the mental obsession had been lifted. I wake up and I don't think about drinking. And I was like, you should be like an Avenger. You should have a Marvel superhero movie about you. that is unbelievable. And I saw tangible things to do. I said, if you do these five basics, if you work the steps, this will 100% happen to you. Rarely have you seen a person fail to literally follow that path. And so I kept coming back. I kept doing these little things you guys told me to do. And the one thing my alcoholism can't stand up to is hope. When I have hope in my life, my alcoholism doesn't stand a chance. And at that time of my sobriety, 2-3 weeks in, I saw no hope in my life. I saw no higher power in my life, but I saw it in yours. I saw hope in your life. I saw hope in your eyes. You guys are doing amazing things, and it wasn't the material things that impressed me, like, oh, that guy has a company, or that guy freaking has a wife. He's able to talk to girls, that's pretty cool. What impressed me is, like, you apologize when you're wrong. Like, you wake up and you try your best every day, even when things aren't going well. When someone, like, does something well, you compliment them. You let people know that you love them. You say, I love you to people. It was all these things, and that's what gave me the hope. But it didn't matter about the sobriety time or anything. You guys inspired me to be the person I always wanted to be, but I didn't know how. I remember I started really quickly after that, getting into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up to a meeting, Sunset Hills, and I remember someone came up to me, Ken, came up to me and goes, you look like someone that would love to make coffee here. And I was like, Ken, man, I don't drink coffee. I don't know how to make coffee. We gotta find someone else, man. And like, oh, we'll show you. Like, what is going on? That was my first introduction to being voluntold to do stuff. And I was like, but I remember he said that Ken showed up 3 weeks in a row to show me how to make coffee. And you know, he gave me a key to the church. He said, this is the key to the church. Let yourself in. Let off. Like, you guys trust me with a key to the church? My mom didn't trust me to have access to my own bank accounts. And you guys just gave me a key to a church. But the same way, there's so many great reasons to do service in Alcoholics Anonymous. There were so many reasons to me doing something that's bigger than yourself, getting outside yourself, helping others. But for me, the biggest thing about having that coffee position was it forced me to come early, it forced me to stay late. And just like alcohol did, that coffee position put me in the middle of the room. It put me in the middle of that room. Because everyone here's had this experience. I would go to other meetings and say, man, coffee at Sunset Hills, why didn't I think it's a mean Joe over there, man? Like, what's going on? Who are you people? But out of nowhere, I became a part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I became in the middle of the room. I showed up to a meeting on Saturday nights, and they said, we're looking for service. And I said, I'm trying to do service. I'm trying to get more involved. And it was Saturday night, and Saturday night is at my age, early sobriety. I'm trying to drink every Saturday night. I need to get a service position here. And I showed up, and they said, how would you like to chair this meeting? I go, I know you. The only person I can ask to lead a meeting is you. You want to lead next week? And he literally was just like, that's fine. Well, of course, you'll meet people. And that meeting was unbelievable. So I showed up on Saturday night, every Saturday for about a year and a half. I had missed so many college football games. I was angry. I was upset. And I would show up every Saturday night, and I think over 50% of the time I would show up, and no one would be there. There wouldn't be one person there. One other person that I had this meeting with my friend Andy from Reston. I'm not sure if any of you guys know Andy, but Andy Deaver had two places. He was at a meeting, was at a concert.
That's right.
And Saturday night, he was usually at a concert. And it was just me. And so I would just be hanging out, and I'd be like, it was just 8:30, it'd be like 8:40. I'd be like, Andy, no one's showing up. Can I bounce? And he's like, no. But someone might show up at 9:15, you're going to be there for them. And at that meeting is where I learned what one of the first definitions of true humility. Because I learned that this isn't about me. This isn't about Quinn feeling good. It was the first time really in my life that I could really point out something that this isn't about Quinn. This isn't about Quinn's emotions. This isn't about Quinn feeling good. It's not about what Quinn thinks is comfortable. At that moment, I got to truly be there for someone else. And let me tell you guys, there were some nights, there were like 30 people up in there. There was some Saturday night, there were some people showed up 24 hours sober. Some people showed up drunk at that meeting. Some people showed up and it was just like, I could have cried. The nights that you're sitting alone and that people show up and just like, spread the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and be there for each other, taught me the lesson of true humility. I'm not doing this for me, I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for the group. My first few months sober, that's kind of all I did. I went to meetings, I had their service positions, and I'm gonna be honest with you guys, those first 3 months sober, stunk. I hated it. I'm not sure about you, I can only speak from my experience. I stopped drinking, and I started only going to meetings, and my life got worse. Because the reality is, I kept showing up to meetings, and I was still me. With all my same fears, all my same anxieties, all my same defects of character, I was still me. My biggest fear when I got sober wasn't how am I going to have fun again. My biggest, greatest fear is how am I going to live in my own brain 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And for those first 2 3 months sober, I was going to meetings, I was meeting sober people. I had some hope, but I was still me. I don't like myself. I hate myself. The reason I drank was so I can escape that person. And now I'm just sitting there. You took away my solution, which was alcohol. I'm not doing the solution that is Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm just sitting there, and I'm in a tough place. Remember, it was October 6th, so I was 2 months and 2 days sober. I woke up, and it just, does ever wake up in LA Supply, and then you wake up like, F this. Man, this is the worst, dude. this is going to be the worst day ever. Like, thoughts of drinking immediately come to my brain. A guy from, I met in the rooms a little bit, he called me, he was like, Quinn, I spent all the money, I can't call an Uber, I need you to drive me to go see my daughter. And I was 2 months, 2 days sober, and I was like, yeah, man, I'll drive you service, right? I'll drive you. I'm driving this guy, he's backseat driving me the whole time, yelling at me, like, changing my radio, and this guy's the worst, man, I'm freaking doing a favor. I dropped this guy off. I've never seen that guy again. I've never seen that dude again. I remember I drove back home, just like, fully content and fully happy in my own misery at that day. Like, rock bottom is a place that I can get real comfortable. I can pull up a pillow, and I can show up and pull up a blanket and get real comfortable and rock bottom. I let myself be miserable all day. I go to a meeting. I made one friend at that point in Alcoholics Anonymous. One guy that was my age. We were talking. We're hanging out. And this guy's really cool. I show up. This guy is the drunkest I've ever seen an AA meeting in my entire life. And that's like saying something. Like, I've been sober for a few years. This guy was very drunk. And he was just yelling at me, pushing me. Like, why am I doing this? What is happening in my life that I'm doing this? I remember after that meeting, driving home, sitting on my couch, I just started to cry. I'm 2 months, 2 days sober, and I am crying. And I'm thinking, like, I just can't wait till I can die. I just can't wait till I don't have to do this anymore. And I share that because going to meetings isn't the thing that gave me the recovery that I need to stay sober. It's important. I need to go to meetings every week. I hit 4 or 5 a week. It's an important part of my sobriety. But the reality is, I wake up and I have untreated alcohol. I wake up and I don't like myself. And so what I have to do is I have to do everything that AA told me to do. I can't pick one or two things. I can't go to meetings, call that one dude, and become a sponsor, I made 3 calls. I can't do only a few of these things. Half my surveillance is nothing. I have to do everything. And so I really, at that point, I double sponsor. I started working steps. I started calling 3 people a day. The 5 things you guys told me to do, call my sponsor, call other people, work steps, be of service, don't drink. The 5 basics. And I said, if you do these little things every day, you work the steps, you will have a psychic change. You will have a spiritual experience. And so I did it. I did those little things. And let me tell you something, guys. I hated doing those little things. It was the worst thing ever. Everything that we ask people in AA to do when they first come in is uncomfortable. Everything that we ask people to do when they first come to AA is really, really hard. When you need to come, you need to go to the meeting for an hour. I need to sit still for 1 hour with my phone off for a whole hour. What are you talking about, man? We have to call 3 people a day. How do I intro a conversation with a stranger? What's up, man? Hey, dude. How you doing? Hey, insert first name here. I tried everything. It's just so awkward. How do I break off that shell and introduce myself and talk to people today? My point is, everything in AA that you guys ask me to do may be uncomfortable. But what I learned is, I have to make myself uncomfortable today so I can be comfortable tomorrow. And I did all those things out of fear. I was fearful of drinking again. I was really fearful of the consequences of drinking again. I didn't want to go back to that hospital bed. I didn't want to go back and look at the look at my mom and dad's face and tell them that I relapsed. I didn't want to do that. So I kept doing these little things that AA told me to do. I kept doing what you guys asked me to do. And out of nowhere, my life went from being fear-driven to love-drawn. I did those things out of fear, and out of nowhere, I started doing these things out of love. I started going to meetings because I loved seeing how you guys were doing. I loved the message. I started calling people because I wanted to hear how my friends were doing. I started praying and meditating. I'm lying. I started praying. I said meditating. I knew my friend Isabel was going to call me on it later. So I said, nah, I'm not going to go in. I'm not going to lie about that. You can make it stay on this program. I started praying. And that was the one time in my day my brain started to shut up. And something that God gave me in those first times, in those first 2 months of sobriety, was the gift of free time. I had nothing going on. I had no job, no kids, no significant other. It was just me hanging out with Quinn. And that could be a dangerous place. And so I started doing 2 meetings a day. And I didn't realize what a gift it was at the time, but people were coming up to me and they were saying things like, man, I wish I got sober at your age. Like, man, I wish that I got sober when you were. I came in here when I was 19, 20, like me, man. I didn't take it seriously. I didn't even listen. I just got myself signed. I left, man. I wish I took it seriously. And it reminded me of the story that I want to tell. I don't usually tell it in any meetings, but I have an hour. It was a cold summer. It's a story of a kid named Wes Leonard. It's a true story. It's about a kid named Wes Leonard and his best friend Xavier, who grew up in this small Iowa town. It's a town of like 900 people. One of those houses, everyone knows everybody. Town closes on Friday nights to watch the game. Sheriff is probably corrupt. One of those towns. And Xavier grew up in that town. He was the best athlete in the town. He was the best football player, basketball player, baseball player. Then Wes came, they were 7. He took that crown from him. He became the best player. So at first they were jealous. They were like, this kid taking all my shine. But then one day, they kind of realized this kid's really nice, you can't beat him, join him, and they became best friends. Wes became the star quarterback, they became the star receiver. Wes became the best basketball player, Xavier was the 6th man. In baseball, they took turns like pitching no-hitters. And their junior year of high school, Wes leads his team to he's leading his team to their first undefeated regular season in school history. It's a big deal for this town, 900 people. Not a whole lot going on in the town. It's a really big deal. Wes is going out there, he's killing. He's getting like 15 rebounds a game, controlling the boards, averaging like 30 points, which sure doesn't follow basketball. Here talking to my friend Isabel here. That's a lot of points. He's going a lot. He's carrying the team, guys. This guy's unstoppable. So he's going out there, and it's their last regular season game. They're undefeated. They're down by 1. Wes has the ball with 10 seconds left. Goes right, throws left, spins in the lane, fades away, shoots the ball, and as the buzzer sounds, the ball goes in. They win. They're undefeated. The students storm the court. Parents are cheering and hugging, and they all pick up Wes and put him on his shoulders. And Wes kind of comes down from the crowd, pumping his fist. He walks a little bit away from the crowd, and he feels his legs get weak, and he collapses. He has a heart attack on the court. Someone says he's too hot. They start taking his shoes off. Someone mentioned that they have a defibrillator in the athletic office. They grab it, and they go to, like, shock him back. And, you know, they never used it before. No one ever bothered to charge it. Wes passed away on the court, one of his best friends and family. The thing is, the messed up part about it is that was just the regular season. They have the playoffs now. And they just lost their best friend. The day of the funeral, they bury him, and they're having a debate whether they want to even play in the playoffs. And Xavier says, we're not going to play. The season lives or dies with Wes. And someone says, what do Wes's parents think? Let's call us what Wes's parents want to do. And they call his parents, and his parents say, you playing. Wes would have wanted you to play. You're going to play. The next day after burying their friend, they go out and playing basketball. Xavier was the sixth man. Now he has to start the place of his friend. And he gets in the game, and it's the opposite of a Disney movie. It is the complete opposite. He airballs two or three shots in a row, overthrows a pass, misses an assignment on defense. And 5 minutes into the game, Xavier's in the middle of the court, he begins to cry. He's 16 years old, he's buried his best friend, and they're asking him to play basketball. He runs off the court, and the coach grabs him and says, Wes's parents are strong enough to sit on the bleachers for you, you can sit on the bench for them. He's sitting there, and this is the part of the story that resonated with me, and I thought about it every single day for the first 3 months I was sober. He had a towel over his head, and his mom is thinking that she's going to get up and pick him up, and Xavier's dad is looking at him, trying to will his son to stand up, not wanting his son to look back on this time of his life, and wish he tried a little bit harder. Willing his son to stand up, he didn't want his son to look back on this time of his life, wishing he tried a little bit harder. And it's not important to the story, but Xavier did stand up, hit a bunch of threes, took his team to the state semis. It's an amazing story. But for me, the important part is, I didn't want to look back on this time of my life at 22 years old and wish I tried a little bit harder. Wish I made myself a little more uncomfortable. Wish I was a little more honest on my course. I didn't want to come back in here 20 years from now saying, man, I wish I gave a little more of myself. And so what I did is I just made myself uncomfortable. I did the little things that I didn't want to do. And for me, my life changed forever when I started looking the 12 steps about Alcoholics Anonymous. That is me where I got the recovery that I needed. Because I said, I wake up and I'm still me. And I don't like me. I'm not recovering from alcohol. I'm recovering from the state of mind that you need alcohol in the first place. That's what I'm recovering from. And that's what the steps gave me. I started looking through the steps, and I remember the three words that changed my life. Phenomenon of craving. Those words changed my life. Because for years, I was trying to describe to my friends what happened to me when I drank alcohol. You guys ever drink and just get this energy? You want to drink more? You guys ever drink and get like a bigger stomach that you want to fill with more alcohol? And like, what are you talking about, man? You're scamming us. You're literally scared right now. And I remember reading that thinking, okay, I'm in the right place. I started doing step two, and I remember thinking, I can't conceive a power greater than myself. And someone said, when it's a higher power of your misconception. If you can fully conceive your higher power, it's not big enough. And as you grow, your higher power grows. You just have to be willing to believe in a power greater than yourself, and it can't be you. From there, I went into step four, and you guys tricked me. I thought step four was I kind of go in there, like, yeah, dude, I'm resentful as hell. Well, everyone knows I'm resentful towards. Then it gets to the last column, it's like, where did I go wrong? It was my part in it. I have to see a pattern to where I went wrong in like the different areas of my life. I learned that I'm one fearful dude. I'm fearful that the girl will leave me. I'm fearful that the girl wants to get married. I'm fearful that the job will fire me. I'm fearful that the job's going to promote me. I'm fearful about every single thing. And it's not like you do your fourth step and you start thinking like, okay, baby, I'm back. I'm good to go. But as I know better, I can do better. That's what that fourth step gave me. It gave me a knowledge of, and that self-knowledge avails us nothing, but it gave me this, it gave me on a paper, a list of where I had gone wrong and how I could be better in the future. And from there, I did my step five. I did my step five on December 21st, 2019. I remember after my step five, thinking to myself, how can I ever drink again? All my worst feelings in my life came from drinking. My worst behavior came when I was drinking. How could I ever drink alcohol again? On March 3rd, I was resigned to an alcoholic death. On December 21st, after working five steps and thinking, how could I ever drink again? You can't tell me this program is not divinely inspired. You can't tell me that this program works if you work it. Rarely have you seen a person fail to slowly follow that path. I remember I did step five. I'll get the step six and seven later. I'm going to come back with a Tarantino movie or something. But I remember I did step five, and I went into steps eight and nine. And it was an amazing experience because I got to go in there and kind of allow me to reintroduce myself. Where did I go wrong? I remember I was so nervous to make all these amends. I was so nervous to say these things and do these things. Like, why would I want to like bring up some of this stuff? But I realized, and like my team took the 89 steps, and the steps that the amends that I was most scared to make are the amends that I got the most out of them. I tell everyone that I sponsor, I say, don't rob yourself of the experience of the 9 step. When you go in with honest and genuine intentions, you're gonna have the best conversations and have the opportunity to be there in your lives the way you never thought possible. I made amends to my dad. Never told this story in front of you before. It's going to be exciting. I made amends to my dad. I went through the whole amends of things. I made a list of things I did. So I did this, this, and this. And I got to the point of the amends. Is there anything that I recognize and remember? And my dad goes, oh yeah! He pulls out like a scroll. I was like, how did you come more prepared to this than I did? No one told me that I'm unprepared to this. It's not an exam. And my dad, he's a lead off a list of things I didn't do. You didn't come back on your sister's birthday. You didn't call me on my birthday. You didn't even think of getting Christmas presents. You made everyone do it for you. You made a list of the things I didn't do. And I know that was the only amends I cried on, because it wasn't like, oh, why are you being so mean to me, Dad? It was like, I didn't know. I didn't know how much I was missing. I really thought, towards the end of my drinking, when I would lock myself in my room with my phone on airplane mode and the soft tour, that I wasn't hurting anybody else. I thought I was really not hurting anybody else. I'm locked away in my room. When I made amends to my dad is when I realized that's when I was hurting people the most. That's when I was affecting people the most, because I wasn't being the brother, son, friend, and family member I've always wanted to be, but I just didn't know how. My dad gave me a list of things I didn't do, and I said, what's the amend to you? So be a better son to me. Be a better brother to your sister. Be there for others. Be a man of honor. And it's so cool in your sobriety when your living amends become things that you look forward to doing. Turns out, my sister's pretty cool. I like being a good brother to my sister. I like being there for her. My dad and I talk every Saturday. I like being a present sign in his life. I get to be there for my mom anyway. My mom's first order of business when I got sober was to get out of my house. I cannot train a toddler. And so I left. Now my mom and I laugh together. We physically laugh together. We go on walks together. I wouldn't have that if I didn't go through the amends. It's this unbelievable experience. And fast forward to what it's like now, this has been the best year of my life. It's not even close. 2022 has been the greatest year of my life, bar none. It goes 2002 was the year male basketball won the national championship. I had my first hot dog. 2003, where male basketball won the ACC championship. I had my second hot dog. And then a pile of like crap, and then the rest of the years. 2022 has been the most amazing year of my life because I get to be here for others. I used to always need like big things to happen in my life, giant things to make me happy. Now I get true joy. I'm showing up on time, saying what I do, meaning what I say, and saying what I mean. Showing up when people need me, being a friend that if people want to call me, I'm available. I get true joy out of showing up and doing the best I can on a daily basis. And it's an amazing experience because God has given me something that I never thought possible is He's given me a life to live for others. Before I was just living for me, now I get to live my life for others. And the best example I have of that is it's like as an alcoholic, what are the 2 dates that you're most looking forward to? Sobriety date, birthday. Like, yeah, baby, it's all about me. I get to hang out. Sobriety date, birthday. Sobriety date's August 4th. It's coming up. I'm excited about it. I'm going to get my chip. I'm going to wear my cool jeans. I'm going to walk down. And I get a call from my friend Keegan. And he's like, hey, man, I'm getting engaged. I want you to come. And I'm just like, cool, when is it? August 4th. What the hell, man? This day's supposed to be about me. Now he's getting engaged. I show up. And that, watching him get engaged was one of the greatest things that's ever happened in my sobriety. It was one of the most fulfilling moments I've ever had. 3 years ago, I was in the hospital begging my mom, please don't make me stop drinking. Now 3 years later, I'm hanging out with all my friends watching one of my best friends get engaged. That's a gift that you cannot get anywhere else. That's not a gift that you think that you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in just wanting to stop drinking, and instead what I got, I get to love myself. I get to share that love with others. AA taught me how I can invest. AA people invested in me and showed me how to invest in others and love others, so I can bring that love to other people. I can bring that love to the newcomer. I can bring that love to my sponsees. I can bring that love to you guys. I can bring that love to my family and friends and be there for them in ways that I never thought possible. I can judge the quality of my life by the quality of my relationships. I have to tell you guys, my relationships are the best they've ever been in my entire life. It's been absolutely incredible. It's just an unbelievable gift that I've had. And the best way I can describe it is I actually had 3 or 4 points that I actually didn't skip my foot back, like actually could dance on at this moment. But the best part about it is like I'm feeling all this joy, I'm feeling all this love. But the biggest mistake I made in Alcoholics Anonymous is that thinking that the steps and the promises of the steps have like a threshold. If I work this step, I'll feel this way forever. If I work the 9th step, fear of economic insecurity, I'll never be afraid of being broke again. It's going to be all good now. I work the 9th step. My favorite part of the entire big book, it talks about how we're like a hot flame from alcohol in the 10-step promises. We'll be in a position of neutrality. And I read that, and I'm like, I'm good at that. I'm good to go, baby. I'm cured. The very next line, we are not cured. We are not cured. We have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And so what that tells me is that I need to do these little things that AA tells me to do. I need to practice principles in all my affairs every single day. And if I do them every day, I'll get more than I ever thought possible. My friend Sailor John has this quote that I'm just going to steal from him. He talks about how happiness avails us nothing. And that sucks. Like, how many should avail us half? Four measures should avail me a quarter. Four measures should avail me 3/4. But full measures, if I take everything, avail me than I ever thought possible. It gives me more than I ever thought humanly possible. And that's just a beautiful thing about that. It's this great thing where I wake up every morning with untreated alcoholism. I have to wake up from square one. When I have to wake up in the morning, I have to treat my alcoholism. I get up, I pray, I read pages 83 to 88, and then what I do is brush my teeth. That's not part of the program, that's just basic hygiene. If you get nothing else away from the share, please brush your teeth. Very important. But I have to treat my alcoholism. I have to call 3 people a day. I can't get drunk off yesterday's bottle. I can't stay sober off yesterday's sobriety. I have to do these little things that AA tells me to do every day so I can stay in the middle of the program and be the person I've always wanted to be. I have to stay in the middle of it. But the good news is, as we all know, if I keep doing it, it gets a little bit easier. If I keep doing it, it gets a little bit easier every day. We have a woman that very bravely talks about how she's 24 hours sober. You keep doing it, I promise you it will get easier. When I was drinking, I was confined to a death sentence. When I first got sober, now I'm confined to a life sentence. I have to do things that I hate doing the rest of my life while I'm doing it. But I'm here to say that I don't hate doing any of these things Alcoholics Anonymous does to me. I don't have to do anything. I get to do everything. I'm playing with house money right now, man. I should be dead. I shouldn't be here right now. But God has given me this unbelievable gift. And what my sponsor always tells me, after like I tell him I did the routine, that you meditate now, and meditate, what are you talking about? After that, he asks me, what are you doing with this gift of life today? What are you doing with this gift of sobriety today? And some of that is, are you helping a newcomer? Are you talking to people? Are you working with new guys? The other part of it is, are you having fun? Are you able to go out and have fun and live the life? Because God has given me an opportunity to live a life that I never thought possible. And I get to be that and show up and be that person today. That's phenomenal. Where I live today is in steps 3, 6, and 7. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to a care of God as we understood it. And I have to make that decision every day. I have to make the decision every day that God's will is greater than my will. My higher power's will is greater than my will. I have to make that decision that I'm going to have the blind faith that when I jump, my higher power is going to catch me. I don't have kids, but what I've been told is that kids, when they're young, will stand up on the second or third step and just jump. And they're not telling you, like, hey, mom, I'm jumping. You're going to catch me, right? They just jump. Because in their mind, your power is greater than themselves. You're their mom or your dad, you're going to catch them. And that kid's right. That kid's right 100 out of 100 times. I need to have that same blind faith in my higher power that when I jump, my higher power is going to catch me. And the height of my spiritual experience is that wherever I am is where I need to be. Wherever I am is where I need to be. If I'm struggling through something, it's because I need to just go through it so I can help someone else going through it in the future. If things are going good in my life, maybe I need to share my blessings. But wherever I am is where I need to be. And I think it's this beautiful thing where I get the opportunity to show up. And the places that I need to be are the places that I want. I know what I want. God knows what I need. I want to eat chicken wings. That's about it. That's really all that I want. I don't really want a whole lot else after that. But God knows what I need. There have been so many times I'm excited for something, and it cancels or doesn't show happen. I'm like, okay, I guess I'll go to the meeting instead. And a sponsor shows up. And then I can work with steps with him. And if you just talk, we just have a conversation, and I get to be there in ways that I never thought possible for another human being. I live today in step 67. When I read 67 in the big book, I was like, yeah, maybe 2 paragraphs. I'm like, I want to read these steps, baby. This is easy right now. But I remember I read Drop the Rock, and it talks about being willing to remove our defects of character, then humbly asking to remove our defects of character. And then after, it talks about it as after we pray about it, we get to our feet and we act as if. We act as if God already removed the defects of character from us. Because how is God going to remove self-righteous anger from me if I'm still acting in self-righteous anger? How is God going to remove alcohol from me if I'm still drinking? It says to get to your knees, get to your feet, and act as if. And just like the steps, just like back to the principles in all your affairs, the more and more you act if you don't have self-righteous anger, the more and more you act with a man of honesty, woman of honesty, easier it gets to actually be that person. Easier it gets to actually be the person you've always wanted to be. I get to be the brother, son, friend, and family I've always wanted to be, but I didn't know how until you guys showed me. That's an amazing thing. That's an amazing gift. And I'm going to kind of leave you guys with 2 quick stories. I've been hurt. No one told me to get more comfortable shoes. But I'll leave you 2 quick stories. I was talking to my dad one time. When I was 17 years old, I won a tennis match. And this tennis match was a very big deal for 17-year-old Quinn. I was very, very excited about winning this tennis match. I remember a couple months ago, I was talking to my dad about it. We were just recounting the story of the tennis match back and forth. And my dad was just going, man, I was so proud of you that day. I was so proud of you. Badass. You won that game, man. I'm so proud of you. And then my dad paused. And he said, I need you to know that I'm as proud of you today as I was that day. And I think that's something I need to remember sometimes. It's like, I can think that after anything important. Like, yeah, I'm sober. I'm supposed to be taking my medicine. But it is a miracle that I'm not drinking today. It's a miracle that none of us are drinking today. That we've chosen to be here on this day. It is an absolute miracle. I remember I was hanging out with my mom, and my mom was supposed to order business when I got sober to kick me out of the house. Now, a couple weeks ago, I'm trying to, I was doing sit-ups. This hot bottle didn't happen by accident, everybody. And I put in the work. And so I'm doing sit-ups. And like, I can't do it. I'm straight up not strong enough to do sit-ups on my own without someone holding my feet down. And my mom runs over and holds my feet down while I do sit-ups. And we do that every day. And there's probably a better metaphor of like people supporting you so you don't have to support yourself. But that's not the metaphor to me. To me, it's really about my mom and I couldn't stand each other, and now we laugh together. I remember I walked into her room one time, a couple of weeks ago, and she's playing like Stronger by Kanye West. She's like, "You ready to do the sit-ups, twin?" What are you doing? But we get to have that moment together. We get to laugh and be there for each other. And it's just such an amazing thing. Like, I'm so lucky that I get to show up and be that person I've always wanted to be. And I'm always going to bring it back to the point that, like, if I got everything that I wanted when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have been selling myself for it. I've gotten way more. I get to be the person I've always wanted to be. I can be the brother, son, or friend I've never always wanted to be. And I get to be a witness. The best 12-step call is showing up sober. There's amazing work in sponsorship, there's amazing work in service work, but the best 12-step call is showing up sober. I don't know when a person's going to be ready to be sober tomorrow or 5 years from now, but they will remember the example that I can put in Alcoholics Anonymous. And show that life can be fun. Life can be fulfilling. You can love yourself today. And I'm going to end on this. Actually, I have two things I want to end on. I'm just going to sit here. It's actually doing my meditation right now. I'm just going to sit here for 5 minutes. But there's a story about a Spanish conquistador, Hernan Cortez, who's a conquistador that conquered the Aztec Empire. And they said that the first thing, his first order of business when they docked the shores, they got all the people off, you know, loaded the cargo, and his first order was burn the boats. And they're like, "What? They burn the boats?" And he was like, "What? Burn the boats? What are you talking about?" He's like, "Because retreating is not an option. Failure is not an option. At no point in this battle do I want you to think, oh, we can just get on the boats and go home. Because we can't. So I burn the boats." That is the one thing that's worked for me in my sobriety. I have no plan B. This shit better work. That's all I got. There is no fantasy in my brain that I meet the right girl, get the right job, or maybe I get cooler jeans, or that my life will get better. This is the solution. My entire life I was looking for an external solution to solve an internal problem. A is the first time I'm using an internal solution to solve my spiritual malady. Not external stuff, as everyone here knows, leads quick. But this internal thing, if you keep working at it and do these little things, will give you more than you ever thought possible. It's base. It's strong. I think something that I've been told very often is that if you do these little things, if you box the program in all your affairs, back in the principle of all your affairs, great things will happen. Standing in front of you today at the gratitude breakfast, I have never believed that more. Thank you for letting me share.
It's meaningful to everybody in this room. I don't think that there's a single person who could take something from you. So with that, I would like to present you with this book as a gift